Take me where the promises are real.
Hey everybody, let's have an AA meeting. My name is Julie and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NAVA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view and the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. Tonight, I get to introduce our speaker. His name is Bill, and he's from Lawrenceville. I do not know Bill, but I'm very excited to hear what he has to share with us about his program, or the program, and his sobriety. Thanks so much.
Can you hear me? Okay, I was told not to touch this desk because it makes noise. I am the understudy. The person who is supposed to be here, the headliner, is sick. I am sorry. If you have a resentment, call your sponsor. My name is Bill, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 17, 1983. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. My home group is the Keep It Simple group in Grayson, Georgia. One thing I could tell you about Grayson, there are cows in Grayson. Oh my God, how did I get there? If you told me 36 years ago that my sobriety would lead from Manhattan to a place with cows, I would have said you were crazy. But I'm here and I love it. I really do. I even eat grits, which I've been told by friends is progress. Anyway, I was raised on Long Island, which is off, for those of you, it's this funny little fish-shaped place off of New York. I'm one of seven. My mother was Irish and German. My father was Italian, and drinking was a part of... Okay.
Sorry.
Drinking was part of family life. I can't say anybody in my... Well, yeah, I can. My Uncle Henny's a drunk. But he's 90 years old, and he's still called Henny Boy, which is a New York thing. You never lose your nicknames when you're from New York. It amazes me he's still alive. And you know, his journey is his journey. I'm glad it's not mine. Anyway, I was raised in Long Island. I'm the third child. I was 2.5 months premature, so I was 2 pounds, 5 ounces. I went down to 1 pound, 15 ounces, and I was in an incubator for 4 months, which is why I have such lousy eyes right now. And my degree is in psychology. There's a lot of thoughts about, you know, infant children needing, you know, some sort of human contact, and you don't get it when you're in an incubator. Who knows? Maybe that's made me a drunk. I have no idea. I lost my two fingers on my left hand when I was 2 years old. Maybe that made me a drunk. Who the hell knows? All I know is it made me feel different. I actually didn't take my hand out of my pocket very often for the first 18, 19 years of my life. I didn't realize that no one really noticed it until I worked for McDonald's and had to give people things with both hands, and no one fainted. So I thought, but it was took that long for me to feel confident enough to actually use both hands. We were lace curtain Irish, and if anybody doesn't know what that means that people were not supposed to know the insanity that was going on inside the house. The house had to look really nice, and everything had to look really, really in place, and you weren't supposed to know that. Oh my God, those people are crazy. And the reason I'm giving you a little backstory about how I was raised is they weren't bad people. They were sad people. I have the sister directly after me was severely disabled. She was born with cerebral palsy, and she's also deaf. And I shouldn't say she was severely disabled. She was disabled. That was a large strain on the family. So when she was born, I immediately disappeared because there was no time for any of the rest of us. All the family's resources went into Mary Lou and assisting her in what was a very, very large need. The reason I bring that up is because I don't know what made me an alcoholic. Maybe I'm just a friggin' alcoholic. So anyway, I was a nice kid. I was a choir boy. I was a Boy Scout. I had a paper route. I did odd jobs in the neighborhood. I was the one that all the parents said, "Why can't you be like Billy Bellotti?" But I had all these little dark secrets. You know, the family was crazy, and I had this odd concept of who I was as a man. All that played into my insecurity and my fear. I was terrified of everything. And then there was a night when I was 16 years old, which would have been the summer of 70, and I had my first drink. And it was, I worked for a supermarket, and which happens a lot, I'm sure it happens here too, but you know, someone's parents, they go away for a week and leave their teenage children at home, and what they decide to do is, let's have a party. And one of the managers showed up and made this pitcher of martinis, and then me realizing, what the hell am I doing here with all these kids? So he drank one and left the pitcher. And all I knew about martinis is that James Bond drank martinis. So I thought, this is going to be cool. And I had that first martini, and I thought, how the hell do you drink this crap? It tasted like, you know, gasoline or something. And I said, oh, well, let's try another one. Which, of course, that's what we all do. I tried a second one, and that wasn't so bad. The third one led to a blackout, and that was my first night drinking. And I can remember, well, no, I got told, I came home, and my parents said, we looked at each other, they were in the living room, and they looked at me like, they looked at each other, and they said, I think he's drunk. And I stumbled up the stairs, and it was my sister's birthday, so I said, how are the men of the birthday? And they said, she had a good time, went up, and got sick all over my 6'3" brother, who was not happy about it. And I can remember my mother saying, oh, Jimmy, you all do it once. Well, that's not true. Because I loved it. I thought I was going to die the next morning. I had the hangover from hell, but I loved it. I just thought, oh my God, I was tall, I was muscular, I was a hunk, I could talk to people. All the things that, hey, I'm 5'6", you know, it's like, no. But it cured that terror. All of a sudden, I wasn't terrified anymore. But I was a good kid. My parents said the next day, we're not happy what you did that last night. And I said, okay. So when I went to a party the next week, and they said, you're not to drink. And I didn't drink. I was a good kid. I wanted to be a good kid. I had one more drunk in my high school years. It was in Lake Placid, New York. One of the guys looked old enough to get booze. He went to a liquor store, came back to the hotel, and I got blotto. Don't remember the night, except my mother brought it up a couple of months later, and I'm like, how the heck did she know? But she knew. That was the second time I got drunk. Now, something interesting happened in New York at the time. It was 72. I was 18 years old, and I had these two things. I had a driver's license, and I had a draft card. For those of you who aren't old enough to know what a draft card is, you had to register for the draft because there was a good chance you were going to be a nominee. And it's the only good thing about my fingers is they said, we don't want you. And I was like 4F or whatever the hell it was, I don't know. But I had these two pieces of ID. So I could go anywhere in the state of New York, and I could drink, and I could buy booze, and you couldn't stop me. I went to my first AA meeting when I was 19 years old. That's how bad the progression was. From being that nice little kid that when his parents said, you know, you shouldn't drink, I did it one more time during my high school years, to... At 19, I went to my first meeting. And you were all very nice, but you were all so friggin' old. I mean, you might have been 30. But when you're 19 years old, that's old. So I think I went to two, maybe three meetings. And I didn't drink for about a month or two. I knew it was, for me at that point, was a significant amount of time. And then I just decided, you know, because I wasn't going to meetings, I really didn't understand the program. I just knew that there was this place that people went and they didn't drink. And I said they were very nice people. But I do remember the person who qualified at one of the meetings had been a postal employee. She had lost her family, had almost lost her job, and she had a DUI and all this stuff, and tried to commit suicide. And I thought, you know, I was this little kid in the community college. I compared myself to her, and I wasn't there yet. So I decided, you know, I'm not ready. I'm not really an alcoholic, you know. And that's why I didn't go back. When they say, you know, identify with the terror that was in my, that encompassed my whole being at 19, you can identify with that, you know. But you don't have to identify with a lot of my story, because my story is going to be different than yours. Okay, 19, couple of meetings, la la la. So I go my merry way. I meet somebody, we move in together. You know, I think, and this person drinks like me. I thought, oh my God, this is what I'm supposed to do. And by the way, it happened to be another man, just in case you're shocked. Oh my God, he's one of those. And he drank like me, so I thought I was in love. You know, it was wonderful. No one saying, oh, you know, you drink too much. You know, he drank too much too. So that was the next, like, 8 years of my life. 8-9 years of my life. And he was a wonderful person. Don't get me wrong. He was a wonderful, loving person. But we were both two drunks trying to figure out how to live life. And I had a DUI. That was one of that yets that postal person had. I ended up getting one of those. And that was a wake of what, you know, a big, oh my gosh, you know, you can get arrested for this stuff. And I asked the cop what was wrong. How did you know I was drunk? Was I weaving? Was I going too fast? And he said, you were going 15 miles an hour. Really straight. He goes, it was kind of a dead giveaway that something was wrong. So I had to go to like DUI school, which in New York was like 3 hours every Tuesday for like 6 weeks or 8 weeks. It just seemed like forever. And at the end of it, they wouldn't give me back my license. Because being such a nice guy, I answered all the questions honestly. And they said, we think you're an alcoholic. And I'm like, au contraire. Not me. They said, yeah, you. And I thought, okay, well, they didn't want to give me my license back. And I talked to my lawyer and he got my license back. But at that point, the way I figured out how to not have to deal with drunk driving is I just got rid of my car. I was like, okay, we'll cure this problem. I just won't drive. Things that should have taken me 15 minutes to do was now taking 2 hours on the bus on Long Island. Okay, so that's, you know, that alcoholic thinking, that we don't process information correctly. We look at something and it should have a really simple answer, like, don't drink and drive. And instead you go, oh, I'll just take the bus. I had 2 suicide attempts in that time when I was out there. And I was really bad at suicide. You know, I one time I'm asthmatic, I took all my asthma medication, and I called poison control, and I'm like, okay, I just did this, what do I need to take? Do I need to eat an egg? Do I need to vomit? They said, no, you need to go to the emergency room. I'm too busy, you know? I can't do that. Well, all of a sudden, there are the 2 biggest cops I've ever seen in my entire life at my door, and they're like, are you Billy Bellotti? Yeah. You're going to the hospital. Yes, sir. And of course, my mother, who had been dead at that point, you know, her words, that lace curtain Irish, you know, all I could think of is, what are the neighbors thinking? Not that you could die. It's like, oh, what would the neighbors think? One more suicide, which was my last drunk. And it was that person who was so much, you know, drank like me and was such a wonderful person. It was the 80s, and he was had the onset of AIDS. So he had something called wasting, they had given him a prescription for something called Lomatil, which was, if you're nursing, you know what it is. So it had an orange label on it, so I figured, okay, this will kill me. And I took it, and I drank whatever the drink du jour that evening was, and I laid on the couch and I said, okay, God, you know, if I die, that's fine. But if I don't die, I'll deal with this in the morning. And I really had... Can you still hear me? I think I moved far away. That's what happens when you're blind to the bat. I'm also known as Blind Bill, Magoo, and it's another story. Anyway, I digress. Anyway, I took these pills. I woke up the next day. I hadn't died, but Lomatil is like Keopectate on steroids. When you said I was full of shit, I actually was full of shit for about a week. My God has a sense of humor, because I was so damn uncomfortable. It was like a week of knowing, this is what stupid stuff you do when you're drunk. But I had to go back to AA. I knew there was an answer. Those 2 meetings that I had done 10 years prior, that stuck in my mind, that I know where I can go. I know where I can get help. Stephen had called the counseling center I was in, and they said, send me to South Oaks, which when you're a kid, you know, South Oaks is... This is humming. Is that okay? Okay. South Oaks is the loony bin, we used to call it. I didn't know from detox and rehab. That's what they wanted me to do. I just thought, straitjacket, rubber room, I'm crazy. So I knew that the only way that I could deal with life was to go back and visit those old people in AA. And that's what I did. I went to a meeting in Long Beach, Long Island, which was not far from where I was living. And for some reason, things made sense that night. I can remember looking at the scrolls, because we had the scrolls like everybody else does, and the only word that came out of the steps was sanity. I didn't see anything else, but I saw sanity because I was so afraid that I was insane and would never be sane again. And people gave me their numbers and said, call me. And I'd be like, you know, I was 28. I thought I was hot. You know, so I'm like, why are you giving me your number? Okay. Little did I know that there was a thing called 13-stepping, but that's another story. So anyway, someone said to me, can you not drink today? And can you come back tomorrow? And there wasn't a lot I could do, but I could do that. He said, don't drink today and come back tomorrow. And I don't know why I listened, other than I had that desperation talked about that they talk about in the big book. I knew that if AA didn't work, I was a goner. So I didn't drink, and I came back the next day. And then they said, can you come back to, can you not drink for the next 24 hours? And come back the next day. And I could do that. And Long Beach is it's a small sandbar off of Long Island. So there's a lot of meetings in a walking distance. So I didn't have to take the bus. I could walk there like a normal person. And it was very doable. Those people loved me back to health. They were amazing. They were amazing. I didn't understand it. I didn't know what they got out of it. I didn't know when they'd want my credit card number for my membership dues. I had no idea. All I know is they wanted me to come back tomorrow. And they said, don't drink and come back tomorrow. So I did. I did. Now that's what it was like. And that's what happened. And now's the good part. This is really the good part. Stephen wouldn't stop drinking, and I couldn't live with him. He wasn't really sick at that point. In 83, nobody knew what AIDS was. It was that thing that was happening in Manhattan, and we were two kids on Long Island. You know, we didn't really know what was going on. So I remember my sponsor knew I liked theater, and that was the only time in my life I had ever stopped drinking. I was 25, and I was doing an off Broadway show in Manhattan, and I knew I couldn't memorize the script I was drinking, so I didn't drink for like a month. But closing night of the show, I got plastered. It was like, okay, I did paid my dues, now I deserve to drink. So I knew I was an alcoholic then too, but the insanity hadn't really caught up with me then. But my sponsor, General Services, had a convention every year, and they were doing a show called The Days of Wine and Roses. And he said, you'd like to do theater. He goes, you're going to audition for this show because it's going to help you get sober and stay sober. I'm like, okay. I played young man because, unlike now, I was a young man at that point. And I had two lines. Those two lines kept me sober. Those two lines kept me sober because I loved doing theater and I wanted to do it. And I said, if I get drunk, I can't do this. So I did the show, and it was amazing. It wasn't a great show. It was an AA show, but it was fun. And I felt alive. And then I auditioned for another show in New York, and it was the same thing. It was a musical. It was really bad. It was an A musical. And, but I that kept me sober, because I said again, you know, I have to go to meetings, I have to go to rehearsal, and I can't drink if I'm going to be in the show. Little did I know, half the cast had gone out and come back in, but I didn't know it. So that show kept me sober. And then there was a one-act play that was incredible. It was an incredible opportunity. It was an incredible show. I went to the audition, and she said, I have to audition another couple of people, but I think you're my Grazio. Can you come back Wednesday? So early on, I was getting all these little messages from my higher power. This is what AA is all about. If you don't drink, you go to meetings, and you give it over to your higher power, you get to have exciting things happen. So, okay, I moved into New York. I had a bathtub in my kitchen. Now, okay, it was a 200-year-old tenement flat. It had a bathtub in the kitchen and a water closet off the living room, and that's where the toilet was. And I thought I was really lucky, because some of my friends, their toilet was down the hall. They had to go out of their apartment, down the hall, and that was their bathroom. At least I had it in my apartment. And it was a dump, but oh my God, it was my serenity apartment. I was never drunk in that apartment. It was just amazing. All during this time, I'm still staying, you know, involved with Stephen, but the relationship has changed. I'm not drinking. I'm living in New York. I'm doing these shows. And then he gets sick. Then all of a sudden he gets sick. And my sponsor said to me, he goes, if having a drink will cure Stephen, that he'd buy the booze. That was amazing to me. That was one of those little things I needed to hear. That there was nothing that could go on in my life that would happen that a drink would make better. His transition took about 2.5 years. And I spent most weekends out in Long Island taking care of him, just being loving, just being there for somebody. You taught me that. People in A taught me that it wasn't about me. It was about being there for someone else. And I was holding his hand when he died. I was holding his hand when he died, when he made that transition. It was the hardest thing that I had ever done. But I knew that AA had gotten me through that. During that 2.5 years, I'd gone out one weekend, and it was a bad weekend for them. I mean, I had tested positive, so I didn't know what was going on with that. You know, and I said, can I steal your car? I need to go to a meeting. And he said, sure. So I took his car, went to a meeting, and I walked in, and it was, you know, all these suburban mommies and daddies, and I don't think there was, and they were all mommies and daddies. They were all like over 50, which when you're 30, 50's old. Now that I'm 65, it's like, I'd love to be 50 again. But anyway, I went to this meeting, and I talked about the fact that I was terrified for Stephen, I was terrified for me, and that I needed to talk about it. And I thought, oh my God, these people are going to throw me out. They're going to say, you know, tainted, queer, get out. And instead they said, you know, we're glad you're here. You know, keep sharing about it. And, you know, if you've ever been to New York, if you see an old Italian woman in black, it means she's a widow. And there was this old Italian woman in black there, and she said to me, she gave me a big hug after the Our Father and said, I'm going to pray for you tonight. And I'm going to pray for your friend. That changed my whole impression of AA. Or my relationship with AA that night. I knew that there was not anything that could happen in my life that I couldn't bring to a meeting. And it didn't matter who I was, what my background was, who I loved, that if I was an alcoholic in trouble, if I brought it to a meeting, you all would love me the way we always love each other. My dad was a miserable man. And I feel so bad for him, because after Mary Lou was born, he kind of gave up. I can remember him playing with us when we were before Mary Lou, but after Mary Lou, he was just defeated. And like so many of us are, before we get this program, he saw no way out. So he felt trapped. And he was an electric motor repairman. My mother was never worked, but he'd bring his paycheck home, hand it to my mother, and she'd hand him his allowance. Now, in the 60s, when this was all going on, men could just disappear. It wasn't like today where they trap your butt down, put you in jail. I mean, there was no way of doing that. So he could have left for cigarettes at any time and never came back and say, Libby. But he didn't do that. He did what he needed to do to provide for his family, even though he hated it. Now, why do I bring that up? I was just like my father. Everything was wrong. The world was awful to me. You all hated me. Not you all, I meant the world. But, I mean, and then I go to this fellowship. I go to this fellowship and they tell me they're going to love me till I learn to love myself. That was amazing. Because you did exactly that. You taught me to be a person. You taught me to be kind again. You taught me to be loving. You taught me to help others. And one day I realized, when I was at a meeting, I'm not my father. And I was going to be my father. And I'm not my father. I'm me. And I'm me because of you. You all loved me back to health. The God thing was bad, was tough for me. I had 12 years of Catholic education. I have the scars to prove it, including told by one priest when I went to confession and was honest. He said I was the devil's plaything. And I thought, well, that's a good movie title. So I was like, okay, the heck with the Catholic Church. And if you're Catholic and it works for you, that's wonderful. But Father Cadogan, you just cured me. But you gave me a God. I have a God today. I have a God that loves me. You know, I am known as Blind Bill. And it's okay. Because I'm loved by you guys. We laugh about it. It's one of the meetings I go to, I tell them, if I haven't walked into you yet, don't feel bad. I will. It's just a matter of time. I will walk into you. I laugh in AA. You taught me how to laugh. You taught me how to... I drank my way out of college. That little community college I went to, they had something called the Garden City Bowl, which opened at like 9 o'clock in the morning. So any class after 9, which there were no classes before 9, wasn't going to happen because I was at the Garden City Bowl. Okay, so, I mean, that's so classy. 9 o'clock in the morning, you're drinking in a bowling alley. Oh, my God. So anyway, I'm about 5 years sober, and I'm working for Brooks Brothers. I'm a member of the Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union, and they know that the jobs that we all had were going away. So they said, you know, you need to go back to college. And there were we were in the credit department, credit collection, so, I mean, there were 40 people in that department, and I talked about it with my sponsor. I said, you know, that's something I think I want to do. I said, I'm really, really scared, though. I don't know how to do it. And he said, okay, let me lay this out for you, dummy. They're going to give you a book list. You buy the book. It's going to have cellophane all over it. Take the cellophane off the book. Open the book and read the book. And one thing you didn't do last time, go to class instead of the bar. And he goes, you'll pass. Guarantee it. You'll pass. I was an awful student when I was a kid. I had a really good GPA when I was in community college because it was all theater courses. How can you flunk a theater course? It's not possible. But I have a degree in psychology, which was useless. But I graduated with honors. And it was what you all taught me in the rooms of AA, how to live life. Show up, do the work, you'll get the results. I have been HIV positive for 35 years that we know of. Have never been sick. Don't know why. Don't question it. One of the things that I thought was amazing in the 80s in New York when I went to meetings is so many people who wanted to die sober. Here they were skeletons. They were still going to meetings and they wanted to die sober. That was so important. How could I ever drink when they made that type of commitment to AA? It was pretty amazing. And we lost some wonderful, wonderful people. But that was their journey. And I have no complaints about mine. You know, I'm here. I don't know why. You know, I'm blind as a bat. That's okay. I have a God in my understanding that loves me. Because my sponsor told me when someone was at a meeting that had what I wanted, I had to go up to them and ask them what they did. And they all did the same thing. They all got a higher power. They were all different, but they all got a higher power. And I said to myself, they can't all be wrong. So if you're new, you know, relax. Relax. You're in the right place. You never have to drink or drug again. And what was important is someone told me, you can if you want to. You don't have to. What a statement. When someone told me that, I don't have to. Because up to the point when I finally surrendered, I had to drink. I didn't know why I had to drink, except it calmed down the demons. So I came into AA. I put my life and my will into the hands of a higher power and AA. And it took a while, but the demons went away. I'm not afraid of very much today. I'm in a relationship today. A couple people here know the person. His name is Andre. He's a little Asian person. He's a DWA, driving while Asian. It's like really which I think maybe it's better I don't see real well, because it's like I don't know what the hell's going on. But he's one of these people that can have half a beer, and I want to slap the hell out of him. That's just wrong. I have never had a half a drink in my life. And it's like, He'll go out and go, you want the 16 or the 12 or the 16 out? And he'll go, I'll take 16. And then he doesn't finish the damn thing. It's like, that's good booze. How dare you? They're a poor, thirsty alcoholic somewhere that want that beer. But what an amazing person in my life. At this point in my life, to be in a relationship, I didn't think it would happen. But we've been together 8 years now, and it's pretty amazing. We laugh a lot. We're both nuts, and that's okay. We laugh a lot. I just have to tell you a blind Bill story, and then I'll shut up. Okay. We're in Paris last April. And I have my little cane, my little white cane. And the French are great with white canes. They let you cut lines. They don't charge you to go into the museums. And I'm at the Louvre, and we're looking at the Mona Lisa. Of course, if it's not like 4 feet in front of me, I'm not going to see a lot of it. And there are like 27,000 obnoxious Asian tourists. And the reason I'm sharing this is kind of like a little AA God shot. Oh my God. The little security lady goes, Monsieur, come here, Monsieur. So I come here, she opens the gate, and I get this close to the Mona Lisa. And I'm looking at it, and I turn and I look at those Japanese tourists, and I'm like, yeah, 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 yeah. So we are not a glum lot. And with that, I'll end. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bill. That was really quite entertaining, and I particularly love the way you described Alcoholics Anonymous, which is truly the most beautiful democracy in the world.
First I slip, and then I crib to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me, and finally waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. I look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are real. For something that set me free, and I'd love to move in harmony, see love as a vision that one day would appear. Thank you. Take me where the promise is.